area competitors envious. An unmatched view of our nation's future.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Joe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on sight and sound broadcasting. Our first article will be from our September issue. We're in the state section. This is news and politics. It's an analysis. This month it's by Christopher Hooks, and his column is entitled "The Governor Unmasked." Greg Abbott's penchant for seeking the path of least resistance has led Texas to the brink of disaster. In the 30 years between 1984, when Greg Abbott graduated from law school, and 2014, when he became governor of Texas, he held four jobs: attorney, law professor, judge, and attorney general. From a young age, Abbott learned to think with a lawyer's mind and speak with a lawyer's tongue. His 2016 memoir, Broken But Unbowed, demonstrates just how important a law is to his personal and political identity. The book, one of those tomes intended to humanize and introduce its politician author to a wider audience, opens with the 1984 accident that left Abbott partially paralyzed when he was struck by a falling oak tree while jogging. But he then quickly moves on to the real subject, his legal career and his proposal to rewrite the U.S. Constitution. By the time he became governor, he had little experience in the kind of transactional and relational politics inherent to his office. So in 2015, at the start of his first legislative session as the state's chief executive, it was unclear what kind of governor he would be. Lawmakers got their first taste of Governor Abbott when they met with him early on the session to discuss legislation. What were his priorities? What bills would he veto, and what legislation would he welcome? What did he need help with, and what could he offer in return? Legislators soon discovered something remarkable. It was possible to stare the man in the eyes, to speak with him for a half hour or more, and walk away with no better idea of where he stood on important legislative matters. He seemed unwilling to speak forthrightly about nearly anything, drawing a veil around his positions lest he alienate some key legislator or interest group. When Abbott did make himself clear, it was to issue marching orders or to punish politicians who had defied him. Some compared him unfavorably to former Governor Rick Perry, who had a much more facile relationship with lawmakers of both parties. Abbott's concept of governing is ordering people around, Republican State Representative Sarah Davis of Houston told me in 2018. He came into the regular session and kind of chided us, and then was absent for the rest of the session. And his public statements often contradicted his private ones. Publicly, Abbott endorsed the infamous anti-transgender bathroom bill in the 2017 session and pretended to advocate for its passage. But in private, he reportedly reassured business groups who worried the state would be boycotted by convention goers and sports leagues from across the country that the bill would never pass. Some speculated that Abbott was counting on House Speaker Joe Strauss to take care of the problem. In time, all kinds of alleged operators, Republicans, Democrats, lobbyists, politicians, advocates, came to share the view that the governor was both a cipher and a bully. Abbott only reinforced this perspective with his repeated attempts to take out Republicans who had crossed him in any way, from the moderate Representative Lyle Larson of San Antonio to the right-wing Representative Mike Lang of Granbury. But if insiders came to think of Abbott as thin-skinned and vindictive, the public only saw a sphinx-like persona. Though he racked up very little in the way of achievements, his pre-K plan was greeted with indifference in the legislature, and the brunt of his energy seemed to be reserved for minor items, such as overturning municipal plastic bag bans. Voters didn't seem to care all that much. For Texans, whose primary awareness of the governor came through softball interviews with local TV anchors, Abbott's ability to remain broadly agreeable was, well, agreeable. but that was in the good times. In 2020, Abbott has been presented with the most severe and sustained crisis of his 5 years as governor. Before the pandemic, he was able to duck the spotlight. Now its harsh glow follows him everywhere. As of early August, Texas counted more than 8,000 COVID-19 fatalities of the 160,000 nationally, which has led some politicians in the state to boast about our low mortality rate. But the death toll is certain to grow, and it is most likely an undercount. First responders in Houston, for example, have reported a significant spike in people dying at home, many of whom are never tested for COVID-19. The model favored by the Trump administration, produced by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, now projects that some 25,000 Texans could be dead by November 1st. We won't know for a long time how many Texans the coronavirus killed or what ill effect the disease has inflicted on the living. Recent evidence suggests some survivors are left with heart or brain damage. But we know enough about what happened to make some broad judgments. There are two stages of Texas's response to the virus. During the first, in March and April, Abbott issued increasingly strict responses to the pandemic, culminating in a statewide stay-at-home order on April 2nd. Texas was one of the last states to do so, but along with local shelter-at-home orders, the shutdown worked. It flattened the curve and saved lives. By making enormous sacrifices, Texans had prevented the virus from running riot like it had in such states such as New York. For the governor, this was an opportunity to gloat. On May 18th, Abbott posted a meme on Twitter that compared the state's low case count and its mortality rate to those of New York and California, suggesting that Texas had cracked the code. If he'd been the protagonist in an ancient Greek play, the tweet would have come with the sound of thunder. He had tempted the gods, and he would keep doing so. Abbott rushed the reopening by promising to listen to doctors and data and gradually lift restrictions. He started to reopen the economy at the end of April when the pace of new infections and hospitalizations hadn't really slowed. Everyone knew the restrictions would have to end eventually, but the sacrifices made in the first stage were supposed to give leaders time to work out a plan for managing the pandemic. That planning never materialized. Instead, there was a long report issued by Abbott's advisory council, made up mostly of wealthy donors to his campaign, on how Texas would reopen and return to economic normalcy. Abbott set a goal for the testing, 30,000 a day, that took weeks to achieve and still fell well short of what experts said was needed. The contact tracing network the state put in place was laughably inadequate, beset by contracting scandals and staffed with a workforce that shrank as the virus grew. By May, bars, gyms, hair salons, and movie theaters were welcoming back customers, many of them without masks. For a few weeks, everything seemed okay, but the virus was silently at work. By June, new cases began to climb and didn't plateau until mid-July. By early August, when this story was written, more than 1,000 Texans were dying a week, according to official figures. How could things have gone so wrong? Texans are now discovering what lawmakers saw in Abbott during that first legislative session, an unwillingness to communicate clearly and a tendency to seek the most politically expedient position, particularly when confronted by the Republican Party's right wing. Neither of those qualities is a good match for a public health crisis. As time goes on, the artifice is becoming more clear. Abbott's approval numbers, though still far better than President Trump's, have been falling, even as other governors have seen a surge of popularity during the crisis. Let's talk about four important instances in which Abbott, who did not respond to a request for comment, said one thing and then did the opposite, in the process making things so hopelessly confusing that no average Texan could be expected to know where he really stood or what the state was doing. First, to mask or not to mask. On March 22nd, Abbott invited local elected officials to implement more strict standards than his own directives. Texas is a big state, after all, and it made sense for locals to make their own decisions, he said. Some mayors and county judges, including Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, responded by requiring residents to wear masks in public. Hidalgo, in particular, became an immediate object of Republican anger. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick characterized her mask requirement as the ultimate government overreach. On April 27th, Abbott caved to the pressure from his right and forbade local officials, even in cities hardest hit by COVID-19, from enforcing mask requirements. He said he believed in individual responsibility instead of government mandates. when case numbers started to rise precipitously a few weeks after Abbott's reopening. Mayors and county judges again clamored for the authority to require masks. Abbott backtracked once more, this time in a way that left observers' heads spinning. He hinted that there was a hidden clause, as yet undiscovered, in one of his executive orders that would allow local officials to put in place a mask mandate, a sort of riddle, one eventually solved by Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf. The governor seemed pleased in the manner of a parent whose child has made it through an escape room. The county judge finally figured that out, he said. Turns out Abbott had quietly left room for local officials to require businesses to require patrons to wear masks instead of directly requiring the patrons to do so. And if that weren't confusing enough, Abbott eventually changed his mind again and issued a quasi-statewide order on July 2nd after 2 months of back-and-forth flip-flopping, mandating mask-wearing in public in all counties with more than 20 active COVID-19 cases. By early August, that included 147 of the state's 254 counties. Second, there were the tight statewide restrictions that Abbott implemented on April 2nd, his most decisive action so far in fighting the virus. At the time, he stressed that this was not a shelter-in-place order, which he argued was a confusing and inexact term of art, as if he were trying to persuade a jury. For greater clarity, he called the plan the Essential Services and Activities Protocols. There was such confusion about what he had actually done that Abbott was compelled to later clarify that it was, in fact, a stay-at-home order. Third, Abbott's order expressly ordained that breaking the ESAP could be punished with a fine or jail time. But then Dallas hairdresser Shelley Luther came along. After she reopened her salon in defiance of Abbott, Dallas authorities ordered her to close down. When she refused, the county judge fined her. Then when she thumbed her nose at court orders, a judge sent her to jail, making her a cause celebrate for the right. In another remarkable sleight of hand, Abbott tried to deflect blame onto Dallas officials, studiously ignoring that his own executive order had set off the chain of events that led to Luther's troubles. Once again, bowing to pressure from his right flank, the governor retroactively nullified the penalties he had implemented a month before. Fourth, because of the Luther fight, Abbott accelerated the reopening of some businesses, including bars and salons, even as COVID-19 cases were not yet on the decline. He had previously said that he would wait to see evidence that the first round of business openings hadn't led to an uptick in the case counts before moving forward with the next phase. But amid the backlash from opponents of COVID-19 restrictions, he changed his mind. Perhaps the most revealing test Abbott has faced recently involves the matter of the GOP state convention. The Republican Party of Texas had long planned to hold its biennial convention in mid-July in Houston, by then one of the nation's most dangerous coronavirus hotspots. It would have brought some 6,000 attendees, many of them older and especially vulnerable to the virus, from all around the state for a crowded three-day party. An in-person convention was a virtual guarantee that some delegates and service workers would get infected and possibly die. It was a bad idea that Abbott's party nonetheless seemed hell-bent on pursuing. What did the governor have to say about it? Would he speak up in an attempt to save the lives of his own party's activists? "You're the top Republican in the state, Governor," said an anchor for KDFW in Dallas on July 6th, after Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner begged the party to call off the gathering before canceling it himself 2 days later. "What do you think should happen?" The governor's answer, "I know that the executive committee for the Republican Party of Texas have been talking about this. I think they continue to talk about it, and they weigh all of the consequences, including the public health and safety measures, obviously. They'll make a decision." The anchor persisted, "You don't want to weigh in on what you think should happen?" The governor paused and then gave his answer. "Obviously, I think whatever happens, whether it be, listen, this convention or any action that anybody takes, we're at a time with the outbreak of the coronavirus where public safety needs to be a paramount concern and make sure that whoever does anything and whatever they do, they need to do it in ways to reduce the spread of the coronavirus." Huh? A day later, an anchor for KENS in San Antonio tried a different tack. "Will you be attending in person?" Abbott dissembled, so the anchor tried again. "Yeah, listen, as for myself, as well as for everybody else," Abbott said, "we will continue to see what the standards are that will be issued by the State Republican Executive Committee, by the State Republican Party, to determine what the possibility will be for being able to attend." Not only was Abbott unwilling to say whether he thought the convention was a good idea, he couldn't even say whether he would be there. The interview aired on the station's 5 o'clock broadcast. Not half an hour later, the party's executive director announced that elected officials would be delivering online messages instead of giving in-person speeches. Abbott surely knew this important fact when he was on the air. It makes sense in many cases for a lawyer or a politician to maintain maximum ambiguity. The question of whether to go through with the convention was a divisive one in the party, particularly among skeptics of Abbott. But again, it was an event that was likely going to sicken and maybe even kill loyal Republicans. What does it say that Abbott was unwilling to speak up, that he let Turner take care of the problem for him? Early in the pandemic, on March 11th, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee held a press conference to announce a ban on large gatherings. A reporter asked him if violators would face penalties. Inslee's response, "The penalties are you might be killing your granddad if you don't do it." That played in news broadcasts across the country. It summed up the nut of the problem before most Americans had started to wrap their heads around it. You might be fine if you're healthy and young, but there are those in your life who will probably not be fine if you contract the virus and spread it to them. It was also pithy, blunt, and a little confrontational. In other words, it was a Texan thing to say. You could see Rick Perry or Ann Richards or George W. on a good day saying something like that. Texans profess to prefer outspoken and decisive politicians, mavericks, you might say, even when we don't agree with them. Yet what we see in the news every day in Texas is the product of muddling through a lawyer's compromise. That's why cities in the Rio Grande Valley and Houston are relying on mobile morgues while Abbott forbids local leaders from declaring a lockdown. It remains Abbott's position that Texas can both open up and contain the virus. You don't have to be an epidemiologist to know that this does not make an iota of sense. We have real-world examples now in countries that acted aggressively to contain the virus, such as South Korea and the Czech Republic. Normal life is returning. Containment must come before normalcy. When you try to have it both ways, you end up having neither. When governments fail, leaders often reframe humiliating national setbacks as evidence of the indomitable spirit of its people. During World War II, British civilians were told to focus on the miracle at Dunkirk, not the reason why their army had to be evacuated from Dunkirk in the first place. As this wave of the coronavirus has appeared to slow, Abbott has represented it as a good news story, the achievement of plucky Texans working together, but he is responsible in great part for the wave itself. The best we can hope for right now is that the virus's rapid spread through the state dramatically slows and doesn't return. Even if that happens, the calamitous surge of infections that has killed thousands of Texans and sickened hundreds of thousands more can be blamed in great part on decisions made by the governor. His unwillingness to allow mask mandates until very late in the game, his speedy opening of bars and other indoor businesses, his consistently confusing messaging. But he doesn't seem to have learned anything. Schools are reopening without a robust plan to keep students safe, teachers and families safe as well. The United States and Texas decided not to make the tough choices required to contain the virus. As a result, normal life will not be resuming here for a long time. In June, Abbott told a press conference that under his leadership, Texas would find a way to coexist with COVID-19 as if the virus had sent us a cease and desist order. If only the world were a courtroom. Next up, one of our featured articles from this month's edition of Texas Monthly. This is The Quest for Better Beef. Vegans want to end the killing of animals. Scientists say livestock are accelerating climate change. COVID-19 is ravaging meat packers. Texas beef is under fire, but all across the industry, from the pasture to the butcher case, a vision of more sustainable burgers and briskets is beginning to come into focus. It's by Eric Benson. When some 8,500 ranchers, stockers, feeders, and meat packers began arriving at the Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center in San Antonio for the annual National Cattlemen's Beef Association Conference and Trade Show this past February, they had reason to celebrate. Per capita U.S. beef consumption had grown for 4 years straight. Many consumers were buying more expensive grades of meat, while chefs were transforming humbler portions, the sirloin culotte, the bavette, the brisket, into signature dishes in some of the country's most renowned kitchens. And thanks to new tariff-lowering trade pacts with Japan and the EU, the U.S. beef industry was poised for international expansion. Demand is unlimited, declared Bill Fielding, CEO of Flatonia-based Art Brand Beef, as I stood savoring a tiny toothpick portion of his company's decadent Wagyu ribeye. and yet a sense of unease hung over the convention. Over the previous year, long-running concerns over beef's impact on the environment and human health had gathered new strength. Blue Ribbon scientific panels affiliated with the United Nations and the Lancet Medical Journal warned that global red meat production was an outsized contributor to climate change and advocated that diners reduce their consumption. Buzzy documentaries such as Netflix's The Game Changers, co-produced by action movie mainstays Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jackie Chan, and James Cameron, extolled the benefits of going vegan. Politicians had seized on the issue too, with a Green New Deal fact sheet highlighting the problem of farting cows and Republicans firing back that Democrats were scheming to take away your hamburgers or, in the words of U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, kill all the cows. Even some who owe their livelihoods to beef has argued against the way much of the industry works. In the 2019 cookbook Franklin Steak, the renowned Austin barbecue chef Aaron Franklin and his co-author Jordan McKay wrote that the current beef supply chain does not produce much good meat and is also negative in terms of animal welfare, public health, and the global environment. And then there's the threat posed by fake meat. Two California-based startups, Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, have publicly declared war on animal agriculture, a prehistoric and destructive technology, in the words of Impossible's mission statement. Sales of plant-based meat products have surged, and the products have appeared everywhere from Burger King, home of the Impossible Whopper, to Costco, 8-patty packs of raw Beyond Burgers. Giant food conglomerates such as Kellogg's and Nestle are rolling out their own entries, and the Swiss investment bank UBS has projected that global sales in the category will grow almost 20-fold in the next decade. It's not that veganism is rampant on the rise, but simply that consumers are eating a wider variety of proteins. A recent Yale survey on climate change in the American diet found that although just 1% of Americans said they were vegan, more than half are willing to eat more plant-based meat and less beef. As at the NCBA conference, the marquee session is typically a state of the industry address by the data and research firm Cattle Facts. This year, Cattle Facts' CEO, Randy Block, took the stage to preach the good news in front of a replica of Green Hall's iconic white clapboard facade. Toward the end of his speech, he sounded a darker note. I see a lot of you in the room that didn't live through what we went through from 1980 to 1998, he said, referring to the industry's decades-long slump after nutritionists and the U.S. Senate fingered beef in the late 70s as a major culprit in a rising incidence of heart disease and cancer, and recommended a dietary shift to poultry and fish. You can see what's Harvard's beef with Texas A&M and another page in this sidebar in this article. A PowerPoint slide on a screen above Block showed a plummeting trend line. Look at these numbers, he said. Beef demand was cut in half. Cattle inventory went down to 20 million head. Now Block pivoted to the present. I challenge you that if we don't handle the sustainability message, this is what we could be dealing with again, he said. I believe this is our greatest risk as an industry. Black encouraged beef producers to fight back. We're always on the defensive, he said. We've got to take the offensive. The industry, seeking to avoid the fate of milk, whose sales shrank 10% from 2017 to 2019 alone, while sales of plant-based milks such as soy, oat, and almond grew 14% in the same period, had already backed the Real Meat Act in Congress, which sought to keep plant-based burgers from being sold alongside actual animal protein in a grocery store meat case. NCBA lobbyists gave conference attendees wallet-sized cards with talking points correcting cattle's climate record. The cards cited the efficiencies of the U.S. beef cattle industry and the widely agreed-upon fact that it has reduced its methane emissions by 30% since the mid-70s, just before onset of the so-called war on fat. But beef's critics aren't going away because of a few talking points, particularly after the coronavirus pandemic decimated poultry, pork, and beef packing plants, infecting nearly 40,000 industry workers and killing 180 as of early August. In the months after the NCBA conference, I wanted to see how beef producers at every level, from boutique ranchers and butchers to sprawling feedlot and slaughterhouse operators, were responding to the climate threat, the COVID-19 threat, and the threat that plant-based meat and consumer concerns pose to their bottom lines. Many sectors of the beef industry disagree vehemently with one another, sometimes to the point of wishing for the other's demise. But I found them all in a mad dash to out-innovate, out-price, and just plain out-argue the forces that would replace them. They share a broad goal, to ensure that beef remains at the center of the dinner table. And a natural spot here to take a break and remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, in 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Now, back to our article. This next section is entitled Back to the Land. Look at that animal wallowing over there, said Taylor Collins, a trim and exuberant 37-year-old entrepreneur and rancher, as we sat in a Kawasaki mule in one of his back fields. A bison calf, a couple hundred-pound ball of shaggy brown fur, dropped to the ground and started rolling in the grass like a Labrador playing in a suburban backyard. 100 bison surrounded us. Most had their heads bowed as they grazed through the pasture. Two bulls, one, Collins says, had genetics tracing back to the herd that famed ranching pioneer Charles Goodnight kept along with his cattle, stood back, eyeing us warily. Another calf pranced over to the mule and started nuzzling its head against the corner of the bed. Anyone would have been tempted to pet it. Collins and I were touring Rome Ranch, 1,000-acre hill country property where he and his wife and business partner, Katie Forrest, raised bison, pigs, turkey, chickens, and honeybees. Just setting foot onto the place evokes the romantic ideal of Texas ranching. The gently rolling, oak-studded land hugs the Pedernales River just a few miles outside Fredericksburg, and the animals graze on native forage just as they did generations ago. Collins and Forrest are committed enough to the pastoral ideal that they've chosen to raise bison, which were in Texas long before the Spanish settlers brought cattle north from Mexico. But Rome Ranch isn't only a throwback. Collins and Forrest have conceived it as a kind of demonstration project to show that eating red meat and saving the planet can be compatible goals. It's a notion that flies in the face of a lot of established wisdom. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has concluded that livestock production is responsible for 14.5% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions, and beef is that sector's top contributor, responsible for a little less than half of animal agriculture's total footprint. Research has shown that cattle take up a disproportionate amount of land, leading to deforestation, particularly in the developing world. Belch too much heat-trapping methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and eat too much food for the amount of meat they give us. Cattle need four times as much feed as chickens to gain a pound. Their food, meanwhile, is often grown in resource-intensive ways, requiring huge quantities of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. Waste from the feedlots, where the vast majority of U.S. beef cattle spend their final months, can be an air and water pollution nightmare. Collins and Forrest concede most of these points, but they think climate scientists and vegan activists have arrived at the wrong conclusions. They are former raw food vegans themselves. Instead of junking beef entirely, they believe we should strive to eat better beef, which must come from cattle raised in a radically different way. This starts with grazing ruminant livestock, cattle, bison, and their cousins, from birth to death, entirely on grass, and eschewing chemical fertilizers, growth hormones, and antibiotics. But the new approach goes much further. Collins and Forrest think that cattle and bison should take up more land, not less, so long as we use them to remake our entire agricultural system, revitalizing degraded soils, restoring grasslands, eliminating monoculture row crops, and in the process helping to trap more carbon and mitigate climate change. The strategies to arrive at these goals come from a simple premise that a good farm should mimic nature. At Rome Ranch, bison are treated more like wild animals than a typical livestock. Cows aren't artificially inseminated, standard practice in the beef industry, where prize bulls continue to father offspring decades after their deaths. Male calves aren't castrated. No calves are weaned. There are some year-and-a-half-year-olds trying to milk, Forrest told me. But Collins and Forrest's biggest emphasis is on how the bison graze. In wild, ruminant animals face predators, and that constant threat helps drive them to gather in herds and stay on the move and avoid the overgrazing that depletes soils and causes erosion. Collins and Forbes initially thought about emulating this part of nature by installing high fences around Rome Ranch and controlling their herd's grazing patterns with a pack of wolves. Then we thought, what if all the wolves get out? Collins said. Instead, Forrest and Collins use a portable electrified fence to move their herd around, sometimes several times a day. This system creates a virtuous cycle. As the bison move through the fields in compact herds, they leave behind their manure, which fertilizes the soil and attracts dung beetles and earthworms, which spread the stuff around and amplify its impact. Then birds swoop in to eat the insects and chewed up seeds. Other birds swoop in to eat those birds, and soon an entire robust ecosystem begins to come alive. As underground microbial life increases, so does the amount of carbon stored in the soil, which enhances its ability to retain water. Collins and Forrest didn't dream up these ideas on their own. Serial entrepreneurs, they spent their pre-ranching careers launching grocery store food products with a healthy hook and scored a major hit with Epic Provisions, a meat-based protein bar company which they sold to General Mills in 2016 for a reported $100 million. During their epic years while trying to reconcile meat eating with their environmentalism, they came across the work of a Zimbabwean ecologist named Alan Savory, who popularized the idea that ruminants, if grazed in high densities and moved frequently, could restore overgrazed lands and begin to reverse climate change. Many soil scientists think Savory's claims are exaggerated. In a controversial TED talk, he argued that applying his technique to degraded grasslands worldwide could reduce atmospheric greenhouse gases to pre-industrial levels. But his core ideas become a central tenet of a growing global movement called regenerative agriculture. A peer-reviewed 2018 study by Michigan State scientists found that an upper Midwest ranch using Savory-like adaptive multi-paddock grazing was able to sequester 3.59 metric tons of carbon per hectare, which more than offset the emissions of the ranch's grass-fed cattle during their finishing stage. In other words, the ranch, methane-spewing cattle and all, was a carbon sink. Another study of White Oak Pastures, a farm in Georgia, found similar results. General Mills, responding in part to prodding from Forrest and Collins, has said it will advance regenerative agriculture on 1 million acres of farmland by 2030, and Whole Foods anointed regenerative agriculture its number one food trend of 2020. Lou Moorman, one of the founders of Soilworks, a San Antonio-based startup that is investing in regenerative farms, told me that regeneratively raised beef was one of the few win-win-win things I've ever come across. Last year, Collins and Forrest and some of their former Epic employees started a new venture, Force of Nature Meats, which sells packaged beef, bison, elk, venison, pork, and wild boar from similarly minded producers in Texas and beyond, including White Oak and Rome. It's not cheap. Force of Nature ground beef costs $8.99 per pound, nearly twice as much as the national average for conventional ground beef. But Collins and Forrest envision a future where regeneratively raised meat is widely available and the price comes down with scale. My dream would be to turn all of our semi-arid crop production land into grazing land again, Forrest told me, like exactly what it was supposed to be with the grasslands. That would mean a reduction of much of the corn production in the United States, a third of which is currently used for animal feed, and likely an increase in the population of ruminants that could actually digest the grasses on all that reclaimed pasture land. Regenerative agriculture isn't settled science. While it's clear that good grazing practices and other regenerative techniques can boost soil health, reduce erosion, and increase water retention, it's unclear exactly how much carbon the soil sequesters and for how long. Regional variability also hasn't been fully studied, and the research showing net carbon negative beef was conducted in relatively lush climates. Jason Roundtree, a Kingwood-raised Texas A&M educated professor at Michigan State who's led much of that work, told me that it would be considerably more challenging to get the same results in more arid climates. But even with the uncertainties, Forrest and Collins are certain the system is far better than what's currently in place. When we went vegan, one of the big driving factors was seeing feedlots, Collins said. You just know there's something wrong when cows are standing in 2 to 3 feet of shit. Doesn't take an enlightened individual to know that there's something wrong with this. Forrest nodded in agreement. She had another dream. To get rid of feedlots, she said, like altogether eliminate feedlots. Next section is entitled Maximum Production, Lowest Cost.
two young black Angus steers, not much more than a year old, but already behemoth, weighing more than 1,000 pounds each, were standing on a pile of packed dirt and manure. They craned their necks skyward, soaking in the warm light. "Look at those guys right there," said Paul Dufour, the 46-year-old CEO of Cactus Feeders, nodding from under his white hat. "Looking up at the sun, relaxing." Dufour sat in a cab of a gleaming white Ford Super Duty pickup as we drove through the middle of Cactus's feedlot in the panhandle town of Stratford, 500 miles north of Rome Ranch and a stone's throw from the Oklahoma border. We were in the midst of one of the densest concentrations of cattle on the planet. The Texas Panhandle is the epicenter of the state's beef industry and anchors the southernmost portion of the South Plains beef belt, an area of Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas, where around half of the 34 million cattle harvested last year in the United States were fed and slaughtered. The Stratford feedlot is a key part of this industry, a metropolis teeming with 85,000 heaving beasts divided up in neatly into 200 pens organized in a checkerboard grid that sprawls out seemingly to the end of the earth. Dufour comes off as almost lab-generated to be the CEO of one of the biggest cattle-feeding operations in the world. A native of Southeast Texas, he earned a PhD in ruminant nutrition from Texas Tech and looks and sounds like a movie cowboy, tall and trim with a sing-songy voice and a fondness for folksy turns of phrase, no two ways about it, interspersed with scientific explanations of cellulase enzymes and rumen-hosted bacteria. He's proud of the massive machine that Cactus has built. Stratford feedlot is just one of 10 similarly sized Cactus facilities. Over the course of a year, Cactus is responsible for fattening up about one in every 25 steers and heifers slaughtered in the United States. All of these Cactus-fed cattle spent the first 7 or so months of their lives on what are known as cow-calf operations, traditional ranches where the animals graze on grass and follow the rhythms of nature. There are more than 700,000 of those ranches in the United States, around 130,000 in Texas, and as a rule, they are small mom-and-pop concerns. The average Texas herd size is 34 head that barely break even. The running joke is that cow-calf ranchers spend $1,000 to make $750. But when calves in the conventional beef system are weaned from their mothers, they enter a supply chain that's very different from anything the bison at Rome Ranch will see. First, most weaned steers and heifers will move to a stocker operation where they'll spend another few months among thousands of other adolescent cattle maturing on grass. Then when they're around 10 months old, they'll be sold to a feedlot. Critics of feedlots see them as the epitome of factory farming, a perversion of our agricultural roots. A ruminant mammal that has evolved to roam around a large area and eat grass is instead confined to a pen and implanted with growth hormones. It's fed corn, which it wasn't designed to eat. It raises its risk of digestive maladies and requires the use of large quantities of prophylactic antibiotics. Animal's concentration in a relatively small area raises the risk of air and water pollution from the huge quantities of manure, the spread of disease in the animal population, and the possibility of antibiotic-resistant bacteria wreaking havoc on the human population. The entire system is built upon industrial corn, which requires copious amounts of fast-depleting groundwater for irrigation. An Environmental Protection Agency study of the beef industry found that irrigation for feed crops accounted for 96% of total water use in cattle production. Corn farming also requires synthetic fertilizers to boost output. They cause nitrous oxide emissions and runoff and degrade soil health, and fossil fuels for fertilizer production and to power farm and transportation equipment. Feedlots for beef are absurd from an ecological point of view, said the author Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, when I spoke to him in February. They may not be from an economic point of view. You have a system that is rational by one measure, but completely insane by another. Dufour sees the feedlot system as rational by all measures, a triumph of efficiency that allows for the most ideal use of the natural resources. And as we drove around a Stratford feedlot, staring up at the hulking steel structure in which corn rations are milled, Dufour made it clear that this system was a highly calibrated industrial machine with every input tracked and optimized to the third decimal point. Cactus's distinctly unsentimental office creed underscores this ethic. Efficient conversion of feed energy into the maximum production of beef at the lowest possible cost. Yes, cattle are fed corn, DeFore said, but around 50% of their feed comes from agri-industrial waste, largely from the production of corn ethanol, an industry that wouldn't exist without federal support, but that's another story, that would otherwise end up in a landfill. Yes, cattle get hormones and steroids to force them to bulk up faster, but the FDA corroborates that they're safe, and they have acres of corn. You'd need maybe 15% to 20% more feed to make the same amount of food if you didn't use them, DeFore told me. Corn-fed cattle also produce less methane than grass-fed ones, mainly because the corn is easier to digest. They also live shorter lives. Hormone-implanted grain-finished cattle can reach their slaughter weight at 16 to 18 months, which means they spend fewer months belching methane than grass-finished cattle that don't reach slaughter weight until close to 30 months. Research is well underway to develop dietary supplements, among them a species of red seaweed that may reduce cattle's methane emissions even further. DeFore can cite plenty of data to back up his arguments. Since the mid-70s, the U.S. beef industry has learned how to produce the same amount of meat with nearly 40 million fewer cattle and has dramatically decreased its carbon footprint in the process, according to the UN. And the American system compares favorably to less intensive cattle industries in the developing world. Every pound of beef produced in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa costs nearly three times more in greenhouse gas emissions, mostly because of less efficient feed, older slaughter ages, and deforestation to create more pasture. Brazil, which has the second largest beef industry in the world and exports heavily to Asia, grazes much of its cattle on vast pastures carved from what until recently was Amazon rainforest. With the global appetite for beef projected to nearly double in the next few decades as economies in Asia and Africa continue to develop, the World Resources Institute has calculated that the planet might need an additional 1.5 million square miles of pasture land, an area larger than India, to meet demand. Modern Texas cattlemen like DeFore have their own endangered future to face. Panhandle is drying up. The Ogallala Aquifer, which supplies nearly all of the region's water, has diminished rapidly in the past two decades, largely a consequence of irrigating land where rainfall is insufficient to support the farming of most crops. That description today fits most of the land in the western half of Texas, which before groundwater irrigation was devoted mainly to grazing. Tilling the land and the overuse of synthetic fertilizers, meanwhile, has diminished the soil's ability to retain water, which has exacerbated the problem. Only with the advent of the ability to pull water from the Oglala has any civilization, with the exception of the Comanches, been able to thrive here, DeFore told me. While we were driving through the grid of feedlots, Cactus's Beef Division President, Trace Hess, stopped the truck next to a field of wheat where a few small cattle were grazing. As our water table continues to drop, we've tried to find other uses for our land, Hess said. This ground in the past has been used to grow corn and cotton. The field wasn't unique. Cactus no longer grows corn, which it determined requires too much water, and all the company's fields are now pastures for pre-feedlot stocker cattle, which cycle through versions of a rotational grazing that, while far less intensive than what Collins and Forrest are doing at Rome Ranch, follows similar principles. DeFore said Cactus's goal was to keep the sun off the dirt by using cover crops year-round. Transitioning the fields to grazing is boosting soil health, he explained. He calculated that increasing the soil's organic matter by one percentage point would allow it to retain an additional 20,000 gallons of water per acre, the equivalent of 3 inches of rainfall. He thought Cactus could increase the soil organic matter of its fields by at least twice as much. Cactus still fattens up its feedlot animals on huge quantities of corn grown elsewhere, and it's certainly not switching over to small, multi-species, chemical-free farming, but it is also rebuilding the soil of its own fields and doing it at a scale, 50,000 stocker cattle, that is far beyond the reach of an operation like Rome. Have you heard this term, regenerative agriculture, I asked DeFore. Do you think that's what you're doing? No doubt that's what we're doing, he said. Next section is Slaughterhouse 4. A Holstein cow, enormous and aged, ambled down the ramp of the big cattle truck at Cavanaugh's Beef Packers, joining a few hundred other animals in a temporary holding pen, blissfully unaware that she was only a few hours from her death. The Holstein hadn't come from a Cactus feedlot or any feedlot at all. She'd spent her mature years at a dairy, but she was no longer producing enough milk to justify the cost of her feed, and her owner had sold her for slaughter to Cavanaugh's, which is based in the panhandle town of Hereford, the self-proclaimed beef capital of the world. Since the Holstein hadn't been finished, her meat wouldn't grade high on the USDA marbling scale, Her fate was to become 1,000 pounds of hamburgers and sausage. The end would come quickly. She would leave her holding pen in an hour or two, enter a maze-like concrete chute, and eventually arrive at the exterior wall of Cavanus's knocking room. As soon as she stepped inside, a young guy with bulging arms would be standing on a platform above her, holding a metal contraption that looked like a stage Klieg-like. The man would touch the end of the contraption to the center of the cow's forehead, a little above the eyes. He'd press the trigger and launch a metal rod a few inches into the Holstein skull, and her life would be over. She would drop immediately onto a conveyor belt, her tongue flapping out of her mouth as chains were affixed to her feet. A few moments later, as she entered the factory floor hanging upside down, another worker would slash her carotid artery, sending blood gushing to the floor. I'd asked to tour Cavanus because I knew it was something of a rarity in the industry, a multi-generational family operation. It's run by Terry Cavanus and his sons, Trevor and Regan. It serves both the conventional beef supply chain and smaller producers. Cavanus slaughters and processes around 2,000 animals a day, including older ones like that Holstein that are no longer profitable to keep alive, and finished cattle from ranchers and feedlots. If you've ever bought all-natural or grass-finished beef from Whole Foods in Texas, it was harvested at Cavanus. If you've ever ordered a 44 Farms brisket or a Heart Brand Akaushi ribeye at an upscale barbecue joint or steakhouse, it was harvested at Cavanus. If you've ever enjoyed a hamburger at Pete Terry's or Hat Creek, it was harvested at Cavanus. Whenever advocates of regenerative agriculture talk about creating a new beef system, one that looks more like nature than a factory, it doesn't take long before they have to grapple with seemingly insurmountable problems. As Nicolette Ann Nyman, a rancher and lawyer who wrote in the 2014 book Defending Beef, put it to me, the slaughterhouse is the bottleneck of the sustainable meat movement. Instead of a robust system of small and mid-sized regional slaughterhouses that would enable beef cattle to be harvested all over the country, the beef industry has built enormous slaughterhouses close to the nation's feedlots, which means that a disproportionate number are in the Corn Belt. Four large corporations, Tyson, Cargill, JBS, and National Beef, control 85% of the U.S. beef packing industry, operating plants that can slaughter and process as many as 5,000 animals a day, almost all of them 16 to 18-month-old cattle straight off the feedlot. This highly concentrated system at once forces uniformity on suppliers and unlocks great economies of scale and global trade. At Cavanus, a series of three giant metal levers strip the hide clean off the carcass to be prepared for shipment to leather goods factories in China and Mexico. A worker with a vacuum tube sucks out the animal spinal cord, a precaution put in after the spread of mad cow disease. The animal's underside is sliced open to extract the stomach, intestines, kidneys, and liver, and some of the organs are placed into boxes affixed with labels in Arabic and sent to Egypt. The meaty sides eventually end up in the deboning room, where several hundred plant workers standing in close quarters slice and hack at steadily diminishing hunks of muscle and fat that hurry by on a conveyor belt. The trimmings get made into ground beef blends. The flat of the brisket and the eye of the round go to jerky makers. The subprimal cuts are vacuum sealed and placed in cardboard boxes bound for supermarket or food service-owned facilities to be sliced up further into steaks or other consumables. The work is grueling, and employees on the line wear earplugs to block the rattle of the machines, which also makes conversation nearly impossible. Packing plants, deep reliance on human labor, the physical work of deboning is the same way it's been done since God made the first cow, with a hand knife, Terry Cavanus told me. Eventually became a major storyline in the COVID-19 pandemic. I visited Cavanus on a Wednesday in mid-March when the country was still hoping it might avoid widespread outbreaks. Within weeks, packing plant workers were getting sick in huge numbers, and packing plants became the bottleneck not just of the sustainable meat movement, but the entire conventional beef supply chain. That's the thing about centering the process around such enormous plants. Slow down the line at just a few of them, and there are ripple effects on price and inventory at supermarkets and burger joints across the country. Some Wendy's locations had to stop selling beef. The episode was ugly. One industry representative blamed the out-of-control spread in facilities on the living circumstances of immigrant employees being different than they are with your traditional American family. Many meatpacking workers live in communal apartments and homes and send remittances back to their families in their native countries. Soon, a coalition of groups concerned with human welfare, not animal rights, was urging consumers to avoid meat. Cavanus itself saw 10% of its 1,150 workers test positive for COVID-19 as of the end of July. Even before the pandemic, disparate voices within the industry were calling for a rethink of the packing plant system, complaining that the Big Four have hoarded too much of the profit in the beef supply chain, and that the dearth of competition at the top has made it almost impossible to make money at the bottom. The Department of Justice, meanwhile, has reportedly subpoenaed the Big Four beef packers as part of an ongoing antitrust probe. A lot of ranchers want out. The average age of a farmer or rancher in the United States is now nearly 60, and one analysis posited that there would be zero ranch operators younger than 35 by the year 2033. The margins are slim to non-existent. The work is nonstop. Rising land values have often made it more profitable to sell out to wealthy urbanite weekenders. Wendell Thuss, a 41-year-old Austin-based cattleman and entrepreneur, told me he was convinced that the future of ranching depends on moving past the Big Four. When I met with Thuss at the NCBA conference in San Antonio, he was conspicuously urbane, skinny, and slight. He looked more like an aging indie rock drummer than a rancher. "I'm not wearing a uniform," Thuss said. "I like to say I'm all cattle and no hat. I get away with it because I own a lot of cattle." Thuss had started a cattle sales smartphone app called AgX that offers ranchers new avenues to sell their animals outside of the auction barn system that leads into the big feedlots and packing plants. He thinks the Big Four's hold on the industry is expiring. They're like Sears, Circuit City, or the taxicab medallion holders. The world has shifted around them, he said. In their place, or at least alongside them, he envisions the rise of a new system of medium-sized, independently owned cooperative packing plants. Facilities like that would enable more producers to adopt a business model in which they own their animals from birth to slaughter, assuming more risk but also more potential upside. Like Forrest and Collins and Moorman, Thuss radiates an entrepreneur's optimism in the face of long odds. The pandemic offered a preview of what his dream might look like. Small packing plants have been booming lately. Davey Griffin, a Texas A&M Extension professor who's executive director of the Texas Association of Meat Processors, which represents the independent slaughterhouses, told me that since the start of the coronavirus crisis, every time I turn around and get another phone call from somebody who wants to know more about starting a new plant. Hannah Null, a former corporate senior manager at Walmart, who now runs the Blue Bonnet Meat Company in Trenton with her brother Ben Busses, told me that in normal years they book slaughter dates 2 or 3 months in advance. Nowadays, with more local customers looking to buy beef from pasture-raised animals, they're completely scheduled through May of 2021. The trend is barely a blip to the major meat packers at this point. You'd need 250 Blue Bonnet meat companies to make up for the production capacity of just one cavernous, which is itself less than half the size of some Big Four facilities. And it's anything but guaranteed that a bunch of small plants would somehow be cleaner and safer in aggregate than a handful of giant ones. When I was at Cavernous, Terry and Trevor drove me out to a field next to their plant that was covered with tarps that ballooned up from the ground and looked like tennis domes. They were, in fact, collecting methane from the wastewater-filled lagoons beneath them. The recaptured gas would be pumped back into the plant and used as an energy source. Terry told me he thought the industry was making a better, more wholesome product than when he began working beside his father, Pete, in 1969. Trevor emphasized that the scale of the slaughterhouses means they can invest in infrastructure and access the worldwide market, monetizing every ounce of the animal. The industry might not be perfect, but it's doing more with less, he said, which he called the definition of sustainability. To him, beef is a simple proposition that is perfectly served by the current system. Consumers want consistency and quality. Prime is prime. Choice is choice. The rest is just branding and marketing. And the next section, it's the last one of the article, beefing up the options for last point. For 40 years, we've had this mantra of bigger is better, more efficient is better, said Matt Hamilton. I'd just shaken his hand and he already was running hot. Is it FDA approved? Is it USDA approved? Yeah? Well then, hurrah, hurrah. Hamilton, the 44-year-old owner of local Yokel Farm Market, a butcher shop in downtown McKinney, is no country hippie. He's well steeped in the ways of conventional agriculture. Grew up on a farm in Oklahoma and majored in agricultural economics at Oklahoma State. Many of his friends have gone on to work in big beef. Saturday afternoon steak 101 classes he teaches in downtown McKinney helped land him an endorsement deal with a cowboy hat company, but he thinks American beef has gone too far too fast and it's time to take a step back. We have three flavors of beef, Hamilton said once we'd entered his store, because some people want the Ferrari and some people can only afford a Toyota. He nodded to a ribeye, a tenderloin, a New York strip, and some ground beef occupying one of the glass meat cases. This meat, his Toyota, and Hamilton wanted to make it clear it was a nice Toyota, maybe even a Lexus, came from 44 farms, sired Angus steers, slaughtered, sliced, and sealed up at Cavernous, and had prized genetics and been raised without antibiotics or growth hormones, has been championed by renowned chefs like John Tessar in Dallas and Chris Shepherd in Houston. Next to the Angus was Hamilton's Ferrari, the Wagyu, world-class beef experience with otherworldly marble meat from cattle whose genetics could be traced back to Japanese herds. The other end of the case was Hamilton's grass-finished beef, all of it harvested from a heritage breed of cattle called the Murray Gray. Hamilton had raised the animals personally just a few miles away from local yokel's front door. In Hamilton's car analogy, the Murray Gray beef is something akin to a Lotus. Temperamental, not for everyone, but capable of astonishing performance with the right driver and conditions. Hamilton is an evangelist for this meat, and grass-finished beef needs evangelists. Mention grass-finished beef to most cattle people and they'll frown in disgust. Grain-finished beef is tender and fatty. Grass-finished beef is leaner and chewier, not well-suited to the American palate. Hamilton, of course, doesn't see it like this. He waxed poetic about how grass-finished steaks, particularly his grass-finished steaks, are as complex and nuanced as a Napa Valley Cabernet, while conventional feedlot beef is as sweet and simple as supermarket white wine. He'll will offer up disquisitions on the right breed and forages necessary to make grass-finished beef that's sufficiently fatty and tender, and he'll be the first to tell you that making good grass-finished beef is tricky, more dependent on the weather and individual rancher's expertise than are the consistent, scientifically calibrated products coming out of places like Cactus Feeders. He also knows that most Americans who tasted grass-finished beef hadn't had the good stuff, since the grass-finished segment of the market has been dominated by cheap imports from Australia and South America. Hamilton's butcher case is a good encapsulation of his vision for the beef industry. He's a businessman who wants to reach as many people as possible, and he's open to different models of beef production, even as he holds up his local pasture-raised grass-finished steaks as the epitome of good eating. What Hamilton doesn't like is what he calls the freight train, big beef with its addiction to yield-enhancing drugs and cost-cutting measures. He's frustrated that independent ranchers don't have much choice in how they operate. He doesn't like that Americans are willing to eat meat from hormone and antibiotic-treated animals just because it's cheaper and the feds have given a thumbs up. He doesn't like how disconnected American food has become from its sources. They did a study and found that there can be 130 strains of DNA in one hamburger, he told me wearily, as we were leaving the butcher shop. And it's true. Hamilton has a romantic view of how to set things right. He built a small business empire based on it. He's the butcher shop, raises his cattle, and he invested in a local packing plant. Most recently opened a restaurant, the local Yokel BBQ and Grill, in an airy warehouse with Wagyu on the menu and a wall of whiskeys behind the bar. Ideas locally raised meat sold locally by local people making good wages. In the back of local Yokel, Hamilton showed me an entire side of his grass-finished beef that was hanging from a meat hook. This was once a common sight at American butcher shops. Now it's almost impossible to find. To get a side of beef, Hamilton had raised the animal in McKinney and taken it 25 miles northeast to be slaughtered at Hannah Null's 8-cow-a-day Blue Bonnet Meat Company. Hamilton likes harvesting his meat this way, but the numbers don't add up. At Blue Bonnet, hides and kidneys don't miraculously get shipped off to China and Egypt for a profit. Another company must be paid to cart those bits away. At a place like Cavanaugh's, Hamilton could earn hundreds of dollars for the drop, meaning he'd get his meat harvested essentially for free. But Hamilton couldn't send his grass-finished cattle to a bigger packing plant even if he wanted to. He doesn't raise enough animals to get in the door. The result of all that, of course, is that Hamilton's beef is as expensive as it is exquisite. When I placed a mail order for some of his grass-finished filet mignon, it cost $38 a pound. I could get conventional USDA prime of the same cut at Costco for less than half the price, and it would still taste great. But Hamilton's business is successful, and since the pandemic shutdowns began in March, sales at his butcher shop have doubled. Other boutique producers around the country, from local organic farms to far-flung ranches offering mail-order meats, are also experiencing booming sales. This hardly means that the end of conventional beef is here. Big packing plants are now slaughtering more animals than at the same time last year, making up for the earlier COVID-19-related slowdown. USDA projects the country will produce 27 billion pounds of beef in 2020, a drop of less than 1% from last year, and nearly all of that is conventional beef. But the pandemic has exposed systemic flaws. Rise of plant-based meats and a steady drumbeat of bad press have opened more people's eyes to alternatives. If small packing plants are booked solid a year out, then maybe some of those would-be entrepreneurs calling Davy Griffin really will build new facilities to harvest local beef. If Hamilton can double sales at local Yokel farm to market, then maybe that signals enough consumer demand that other butcher shops will begin offering an alternative to the conventional supply chain, eventually nudging down the price. If the ideas of regenerative agriculture continue to spread, then maybe more water and soil-depleting cornfields will become water-retaining, soil-enhancing grasslands. Maybe more of the organizations transforming those lands will be big beef pillars like Cactus Feeders, for whom renewing natural resources may be as much of an economic necessity as an ecological one. Why couldn't every one of those solutions coexist on the industry menu, even if they don't show up together on one plate? As we were enjoying a lunch of Wagyu sirloin, Hamilton told me he worries that the industry doesn't appreciate that the next generation, 20-somethings like his daughter, have choices that previous generations didn't. Young adults could ensure a future burger knife here and abroad, or they could look at the problems of beef and bunch up their noses as folks did in the 80s, only this time they could turn to Beyond Meat or whatever comes after that. We've got to say to that person, we've fixed our problems. It's okay to eat beef, and here's why it's okay. He locked eyes with me as he chewed a bite of his velvety steak. We don't adapt and create the products that the next generation.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30. Are you registered to vote? The last day to register is next Monday, October 5th, for the November 3rd election. In Odessa, register in person at 1010 East 8th Street, Suite 101, or for more information, call 498-4030. In Midland County, applications can be picked up at locations including the Downtown and Centennial Libraries and the Elections and Voter Registration Office. For more, call 688-4890.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the September issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the article Link by Link, Five Small Town Sausage Festivals Trace the Travels of a Visionary Catholic Priest, by Lee Williams. In December 1891, a Catholic priest moved from St. Louis, Missouri, to Texas for the drier climate. In 3 decades, Father Joseph Reisdorf established 5 towns across North Texas in the Panhandle: Windhorst, Rhineland, Nazareth, Umbarger, and Slayton. These were places for German Catholic immigrants to call their own, where they could farm, live, and worship. Today, these communities gather annually and biannually to celebrate their German heritage and Catholic faith with sausage festivals that raise funds for local churches and towns. While Reisdorf doesn't have a direct link to sausages or these events, it's undeniable that his influence, even nearly a century after his death, is still palpable in these 5 communities. "We're all connected by him," says Annel Welch, a Rhineland native who helps run the local sausage festival. Dining on hot links, sauerkraut, and sweets among these friendly small-town folks reveals a sincere appreciation for this little-known part of Texas history and the turn-of-the-century German Catholic priest who relied on sheer will and a dream. Windhorst Sausage Meal, Windhorst. Reisdorf's first stop in Texas was in Windhorst, about 30 miles south of Wichita Falls, where he founded St. Mary's Catholic Church. The town of about 400 is surrounded by rolling green pastures and tin-roof barns. The church can be spotted from miles away, perched atop the highest point in Archer County. At the base of the church is a grotto and shrine that opened in 1950. During World War II, 64 servicemen from Windhorst sent portions of their pay home to finance the structure. Every man returned, and their names are displayed in the grotto, which serves as a testament to faith during hard times. Windhorst has 2 sausage festivals put on by the Knights of Columbus, an International Catholic Fraternal Service Association, on the first Sundays of December and March. "People around here mark their calendars with those dates," says Debbie Schroeder, a city secretary who was born and raised in Windhorst. The handmade pork sausage recipe was perfected by late Knights of Columbus member Oliver Cotter, and after he died, the torch was passed to his 2 sons. Parishioners also contribute ribs, sauerkraut, green beans, and salad. We're still very much a German Catholic community, Schroeder says. That's our heritage. And their festival is December 6, 2020, and March 7, 2021. Rheinland, sausage and fried chicken dinner, Rheinland. Reisdorf's next stop became Knox County, where he purchased 12,000 acres to be sold to German Catholic farmers. He named the town after the Rhine Valley, his home in Germany. St. Joseph's Catholic Church remains the anchor of the community, with its stained glass windows and ornate artwork. A sign on the highway reads, "A Cathedral in a Cotton Patch." Today, Rheinland, about 80 miles southwest of Wichita Falls, only counts about 50 residents. But St. Joseph's Parish serves about 150 families, most of whom live on farms or in nearby towns. Last year's sausage festivals attracted people from surrounding towns such as Mundy, Knox City, Seymour, and Haskell, but also as far as Lubbock, Abilene, Wichita Falls, and Dallas-Fort Worth. The fundraiser meals take place in October and March, with proceeds from the October event going to the Knights of Columbus, and proceeds from the March event going toward the church. Guests can dine on handmade pork sausage, sauerkraut, green beans, mashed potatoes, salad, desserts, and, of course, the famous fried chicken made by the Knights and community members. We had some folks from Windhorst over, and they said they came for the fried chicken, Rheinland native Janet Dillard says. And their festivals are scheduled for October 11, 2020, and March 21, 2021. Germanfest and Suds and Sounds, Nazareth. Reisdorf brought four farmers with him to the vast and windy plains of the Panhandle. Like he'd done in Windhorst and Rheinland, Reisdorf took out ads in Midwestern German Catholic newspapers, encouraging settlers to move to Nazareth, where farmland was plentiful and affordable. Matt Olvera has spent most of his life in Nazareth and runs M.O. Supply downtown. He's also one of the organizers of the annual German Sausage Festival and Suds and Sounds Country Music Concert. The Sausage Festival started in 1972, and the concert was added in the late 1980s. It's usually a different crowd for Suds and Sounds, Olvera says. It's geared more toward the 25 to 35 crowd. The sausage is usually made by Keeter's Meat Company in Tulia, using a special recipe that's been in place since the first festival in Nazareth. Residents of the town make the rest of the food, including the coveted German chocolate cake. Most of the residents of Nazareth grew up there and understand what it takes to pull off the jam-packed day of events. It's a lot of work and takes a community effort to get it all done, Olvera says. And their festival is scheduled for July 10, 2021. German Sausage Festival, Umbarger. In 1908, after his stint in Nazareth, Reisdorf moved 30 miles up the road to Umbarger. He was a colonizer and didn't stay in Nazareth very long, says Daryl Birkenfeld, a former priest based in Nazareth. He liked biblical names and wanted to name Umbarger after Bethlehem, but the postmaster thought otherwise. Like Rheinland, the community never incorporated, but it has remained loyal to St. Mary's. The church was mostly finished in 1929, but its artwork was completed during World War II by a group of Italian prisoners of war detained in nearby Hereford. The paintings were restored in 2012 and are available to view during the Sausage Festival. The church is a big draw, says Harold Artho, the festival's publicity director for almost 30 years. People love to see it. The festival prides itself on its beef and pork sausages, mashed potatoes, applesauce, fresh baked bread, and sauerkraut, all crafted by church parishioners. I'm pretty sure we're the only festival around here that still makes our own sauerkraut, Artho says. We start peeling 3,500 pounds of cabbage in September. And their festival is slated for November 8, 2020. And finally, St. Joseph's Sausage Festival and Oktoberfest, Slayton. After Umbarger, Reisdorf traveled to the developing railroad community of Slayton, where he continued to recruit German Catholics from the Midwest and German Lutherans from Central Texas. Reisdorf served as the first priest at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Slayton, but he stayed occupied as a businessman and was paid a commission on land sold in the area to Catholic families. Reisdorf remained the parish priest until 1917, when he went on sick leave. He lived in Slayton until his death in 1922, and is buried in Jefferson City, Missouri.